Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Extra from Guardian Unlimited. Ian McEwan is one of Britain's most successful and important writers, with novels such as the Booker Prize-winning Amsterdam and his masterpiece Enduring Love. Science often plays a prominent role in his work, and James Randerson and I asked him why he's drawn to the subject.
Well, it seems an all-too-human process, an amazing invention. It's easy enough to imagine a world without science. Historically, we've had it so. And it does seem to be an extraordinary matter that somehow we have invented and evolved a thought system that is self-correcting, unlike most other systems of thinking that rely heavily on, say, sacred texts or fixed premises. This is a huge collegiate process, sometimes rather bitter, but on the whole rather cooperative. Rather like a ship correcting course. And I don't think there's anything quite like it in intellectual history. Curiosity seems to me one of the greatest human attributes. And science seems to me a sort of codified form of curiosity. What extends from that is that it therefore seems to me a marvelous form of engagement with the world. I far prefer the pursuit of and the satisfaction of curiosity than other forms of, say, worship of the world. It both loves the thing that it contemplates, but it's also sceptical and sometimes quizzical about it. So that's what draws me to it.
Your novel Saturday, the main character is a neurosurgeon, and one of the interesting things about that book is that there are quite detailed descriptions of brain surgery. I just wondered if you could take us through some of the research you did for that novel. How did you actually go about finding out all that stuff?
Neurosurgery is not quite science, as I'm sure you know. And as I say, in Saturday, it's more like plumbing. I mean, brilliant plumbing. Far removed, say, from neuroscience, and deals at a macro level with the brain in ways that are quite frightening to contemplate. And brain surgeons are traditionally very bold figures who go in where others would be rather wary. I spent, over a period of 2 years, a lot of time with one particular neurosurgeon called Neil Kitchen at the National Hospital. At first I just spoke to him in his office, and then when I felt more confident of what I wanted to see, I started to shadow him in the operating theatre. And it was an odd kind of research, because when I started, I didn't really know what I wanted. It was one of those research projects that dictated what went into the novel.
What was it that sort of piqued your interest most about the whole thing?
Crudely, at the beginning, I simply was interested in seeing a living brain.
So back to your curiosity.
Long ago, when I was in my early 20s, I've been very interested in the mind-body problem. Curiously then, it had no reference to the brain, no reference to anatomy, no reference to neuroscience. It was simply armchair speculation and the marking out of positions in relation to, say, Descartes and all the rest. But it still, for me, seemed a matter of wonder, the relationship of mind and brain. And in the mid to late 80s, I started to read a bit more about neuroscience, and I have a very good hiking friend who's a neuroscientist, and so I engaged in lots of conversations with him. And so when I was casting around for a profession to give to a character, there was some history for me, some curiosity to be satisfied in allowing him to be a neurosurgeon. Neurosurgeons don't sit around wondering about the mind-body problem, nor are they all that interested in how complexly arranged matter generates consciousness. They can't afford to be thinking about that in the pressures of their week. Although most of the neurosurgeons I spoke to said that it did still hold them when they stood back from it, but week on week they don't really consider it. So I did have some quite long history in this matter. I got very involved in just watching a number of routine procedures, clipping an aneurysm, for example, an MCA aneurysm. Once you've seen it three or four times, you see the both its extraordinary dangers and difficulties. Major arteries have to be circumnavigated. The intense degree of cooperation and a weird kind of boldness that is very, very far removed from what we know of the delicacy and intricacy and sort of amazing micro wonder of the connectivity of the brain. I mean, brain surgeons are either clipping aneurysms, relieving pressure above or below the dura, hematomas, and removing cancers, tumors, and finding roots to these places without compromising delicate material around them seem to be the extraordinary skill. When I talk to the neurosurgeon about whether he contemplated often how it was that the brain codified experience, it sort of amused me that actually, having been doing it for 15, 20 years, he could no longer afford to think in those ways. Yet around about the same time, I was seeing quite a lot of James Watson. And I said, if you were a young man and starting your career in science again, what do you think is the most powerful, important question you'd want to address? And he said exactly that, how the brain codifies experience. He said, we're nowhere near that. Huge strides have been made in the last years, especially with non-invasive fMRI.
So a version of consciousness.
But yes, and it interested and satisfied me that he, at the end of his working life, if he had it all over again, would start right there.
Did he feel like he could answer that question, though?
No, he didn't.
It's interesting that Crick went down similar lines, actually, didn't he?
With his astonishing or astounding hypothesis.
Yeah. In terms of your own formal education, how far does your science background sort of extend?
Oh, it stopped at O-level. I was forced to make that traditional choice at the age of 16. I agonised over it. I was very tempted to go and do physics, biology, and two maths A-level. But on the other hand, I was very interested in doing history, French, German, and English. And in the end, made almost a random decision.
Do you think for people with a sort of similar background, it's possible to get an education in science from popular culture or from popular science books?
I do think it has been this last 20 or 30 years. I think we've lived through a golden age of science writing. Truly privileged, I think we are, as laymen, to have so many either very gifted journalists or a handful of extremely good and literate, motivated scientists who want to communicate. And in these past couple of decades or so, the urgency of speaking out of your subject, sometimes to not only laymen, but to scientists in other fields or related fields. So, you know, there are works by, I don't know, Dan Dennett or Steven Pinker, and they're actually carrying out work of synthesis within, you know, trying to stitch together what it is they've been doing and present it to a readership that will include other thinkers in the same field.
I mean, are they sort of the highlights? Are they the sort of masters of the popular science genre, or are there others who you'd pick out?
I've been always full of admiration for Dawkins and Selfish Gene and onwards. But I would name, I mean, a particularly intellectual hero for me is E.O. Wilson, whose work spreads out from biology. He's obviously a great expert on ants, and I love that book on ants, into speculations, you know, that spread right across the nature of science itself and into speculation on whether we can recapture something of the great 18th century Enlightenment project of the synthesis between science and the humanities, or science and the social sciences, a somewhat discredited ambition that lately has began to acquire a new momentum. And he writes very well, and he's very literate. His terms of reference are as as broad as any sort of thinker educated in the humanities. Another scientist I like a great deal and always listen to and follow is Steven Weinberg, the physicist, Nobel Prize winning physicist. Wonderful clarity in his writing, great wit, extremely good historical sense. He wrote an essay that recapitulates Huxley's famous lecture called On a Piece of Chalk, which Huxley used to tour the country giving to working men's clubs. Weinberg revitalizes this essay in order to celebrate reductionism, rescue reductionism as a term of abuse, and actually show us what a very powerful intellectual tool it is. And it's a wonderful piece of sheer intellectual brilliance. And there's a real joy in it, actually. And to those who, many of my friends, perhaps most of my friends educated in the humanities, who are really rather skeptical about science or my interest in it, I always try to convince them of the sheer intellectual joy of it, and that we all can possess it. I mean, it's a great mistake to think that the work of someone like Weinberg or E.O. Wilson belongs only to the consideration of other physicists or other biologists. And just as we might not be able to play an instrument or compose music and yet still have an opinion about Mozart, and similarly in painting, or not be a novelist and yet still have plenty of opinions about novels that we read, so we can celebrate and take great joy in what is really just a matter of human ingenuity. And we're somehow implicated because we're human too. I've liked a great deal the work of Damasio, a neuroscientist who has tried to push forward an idea really which you find in Darwin, emotions as physical states and the importance of emotion in cognition generally. Steven Pinker's book, The Language Instinct, he's a sort of Darwinian psycholinguist, and that to me seemed one of the most entertaining and stimulating books on the nature of language and of speech. What else has meant a lot to me? Among the dead scientists, well, I think one of the greatest and early writers on science for laymen was Voltaire. He had to seek refuge in England after a spot of bother in France and witnessed Newton's funeral at Westminster Abbey and was amazed that a scientist, a mere natural philosopher, should be laid to rest with such pomp. And then he goes on to give an explanation to the friends back home of Newton's theory of optics, which is, I think still remains one of the most lucid explanations of Newton's ideas. James Watson's book on the discovery of the double helix is a great classic of scientific reportage. That's the, you know, the history and the biography of it rather than the science of it. At the same time, I've got a collection of old Nature papers, and Crick and Watson's 1,200-word letter to Nature, I think, is still one of the most lovely and succinct and slightly mischievous towards the end. It has not escaped our notice.
Talking of human geniuses, Darwin makes an appearance in Saturday as well in the form of a quote from The Origin of Species.
Yes.
What's your fascination about Darwin and his ideas?
He is the most influential thinker that ever was within not only one field, but the repercussions have been colossal. The idea that he had, natural selection, is a relatively simple idea which a layman can get his mind around. And yet the ramifications of it are near infinite. the shape of his life interests me, that as a young man makes this bold journey around the world, comes back, marries Emma, moves down to Kent, never budges, barely get himself up to London to give an after-dinner speech after a while. So rooted and then so driven. 8 years on barnacles, or, years on earthworms. Driven and pained by the implications of what he was discovering. I mean, in the expression of emotion, human and animals, he was so far-sighted. The universal nature of emotion, so good on that. Marvellous book, actually. I think Paul Ekman's third edition of that is a great piece of scholarship. One of the first books ever, possibly the first book on science to contain photographs, pictures of his own son sitting in a high chair having a screaming fit, and Darwin just noting the upper lip curls just before, you know, lovely sort of mixture of tenderness and objectivity. Rarely has a man so humble had, you know, in his manner, his personality had such colossal effect.
Have you tried to deal with some of those issues of Darwin and the way he changed the world in your books?
I don't think I've ever really addressed it directly. I mean, it's a big subject and hard to incorporate into fiction, I think. But in Saturday, Henry Perron reflects on that line about there being grandeur in this particular view of the world. In other words, it's a sort of celebration of the project of science that Darwin evokes in the final pages of The Origin, when he thinks that as he passes a hedgerow and looks into its fantastic abundance of forms, life forms, that they are driven by basic physical laws. Instead of finding this bleak and abstract, cold, he finds it wondrous. That's really the kind of metaphysic that I give to Henry Perron, who, in a not entirely facetious conversation with his daughter once, says that if he had to invent a religion, and they're talking about a Larkin poem, which Daisy quotes to him, if I were called in to construct a religion, I should make use of water. And Henry Perron says, well, if I were called in, I'd make use of evolution because it is a most extraordinary narrative. He really recapitulates and embellishes on Darwin's last couple of pages, the end of The Origin, on how out of natural processes, physical laws, and the highly organizing and organized nature of natural selection, complicated and ever more complicated life forms evolve, and out of them come cities and love and art. And Henry then says, you know, and this would have the added quality of happening to be true, unlike other narratives. And at which point Daisy says, well, you really sound like a fundamentalist now, claiming that it happens to be true.
I mean, as beautiful as that narrative is, the idea of natural selection, clearly some people feel threatened by it, religions, some religions in particular. I mean, what do you make of this idea of intelligent design and teaching it in science lessons, something that many scientists in this country have really spoken out against in very strong terms? Why do you think people are threatened by Darwin's ideas?
Well, I think they are very powerfully threatening in a sense, because they don't give us the benefit of a purposeful universe. There's a level of randomness there. They posit a world that could organize itself without a god. And to many people who need or want or demand a personal, organizing, vengeful or benevolent god, they find this threatening. I don't. I mean, I find it exhilarating, liberating. But I accept that many people find it peculiarly bleak. As for intelligent design, which is just creationism in another form, well, I think it belongs in theology lessons, and it's got nothing to do with science any more than the Flat Earth Society should demand a role in geography lessons. It's over with that. We know enough now. And we know enough, I mean, people like to say, well, you know, science has been wrong about things before. But when you get such a degree of consonance across many different separate scientific fields, the consilience that E.O. Wilson talks about, then I think, you know, the matter is clear. I mean, even the Pope in 1975 or 6 was accepted that natural selection was not a mere kind of one theory competing among others. The evidence is as great as we have for any idea. So I was very heartened by Judge John Jones III, 160-page summing up verdict on the in the Dover, Pennsylvania case. There he was, a Bush appointee. Everyone said, well, he's a Republican judge, he's bound to go with the creationists. But in fact, he was a judge more than he was a political animal. And he listened to the evidence and gave actually one of the best summings up of evolutionary theory, and a really heartening, rallying call to founding fathers and the Enlightenment project of the American Republic. I think it's a great document of our time.
Do you think that science or rationalism is under attack, particularly from the American Bible Belt, for example?
I think in Europe we overplay this. I think we go on about American sort of Baptist fundamentalists and forget that the United States owns about 4/5 of the world's science. And recent books by Sam Harris, Dan Denny, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Attacking God, have been hugely popular. Atheistic works. Hitchens' book has been 15 weeks in the New York Times bestseller list. Richard had a most incredible success. And I should also add that when Christopher Hitchens took his book across the Bible Belt, stopping in many towns to debate with fundamentalist preachers, thousands turned out, and many of them said to him, look, we hate being called the Bible Belt. We're not all like, crazed preachers. So there is a strain, a very strong, powerful strain of both atheism and rationalism in American society. And I think we tend to rather overplay that other element. Largely, I suppose, because we've lived with the Bush administration and its pandering to the Christian right. But I don't think they have really a coherent worldview that can really challenge or predict or explain either the cells of a sycamore leaf or the structure of the cosmos. And science, at least, is along the road to providing those kinds of descriptions and explanations.
Earlier on, you mentioned the E.O. Wilson's contribution to the sort of Enlightenment project of synthesis between science and humanities and social sciences. There's a kind of two cultures idea of, strangely, amongst sort of polite society, it's okay to say, I've never heard of Mendel, but it's not okay to say, well, I don't really understand that, what all the fuss is about with that Shakespeare chap. Is that changing at all? And why is that the case?
Why do we interesting not value question. Science? I mean, the two cultures matter ever since C.P. Snow named it in that way, and as I say, has been with us. And I think there is still quite a strong sense of having no intellectual shame in knowing absolutely nothing about science. People sometimes ask me, why am I so interested in science? And I realise it's not science I'm interested in, it's the world that it explains, and it seems to me just simply a matter of intellectual curiosity. So I don't really understand how you could live without it, because it basically provides us with explanations that religion no longer can. The cosmos, according to Christianity, is clearly defunct. I mean, there's nothing it can tell us about the nature of life. And religion in general does close down curiosity, seeks no explanations. It doesn't need to, because it can refer everything back to God. So there's a peculiar arrogance about religion. Lack of humility, lack of genuine curiosity, because it can always hive things off and say it's God's will or it's God's mystery. Is it changing? Have we moved on since whenever it was, 1959, when Snow wrote his essay? I think a little bit, largely because science has intruded itself on everyone's thoughts through public policy, whether it's CJD or BSE or the ethics of genetics-based medicine, or having to think about climate change and the role of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. Some of these basic things now are grasped by far more people. And everyone owns a computer, so they've had to get their mind a little around a different way of thinking about information.
Is there a sense that amongst sort of thoughtful society dinner party conversation, if you can't have something sensible to say about CJD or climate change, then you're going to be left out of a lot of conversations?
I don't really know about that, but I think it's probably less acceptable now to simply say, I don't know a thing about science and don't care about it. And the odd thing is that many of the scientists I know are also just as literate as anyone else. Or as literate as literary people. It's quite easy for them to bolt on a good reading of contemporary fiction, or have been to see the Anthony Gormley show at the Hayward, or, certainly the best of the scientists seem to be very cultured men and women. But I think there has been a slight shift. I don't think those educated in the humanities can afford now to be quite so dismissive. Mm-hmm. And anyone starting a magazine, say like Prospect, or a thoughtful newspaper like The Guardian, would now really have to dedicate pages to science. And I think also we've lived through an extraordinary time of gadgets, from iPods on. And I think that stimulates a sort of street-level respect for these Stanford-based young, hot geniuses who are inventing things on the internet, or little white boxes for us to put in our pockets.
Just finally, with your obvious interest in science, have you ever considered writing any science fiction?
No, not really. I have fairly conventional and, I'm sure, quite worthless prejudices against science fiction. I want to write fiction that would have not science in it, but suffused with a kind of consciousness that respects that way of thinking. I'm not interested in a fiction that has full of gadgets or wants to invent fantasy worlds or planets or gravity-defying gizmos or anything like that. Trying to understand what we've got, what stands before us on this planet, seems to be a big enough task to me.
That was Ian McEwan speaking with me and The Guardian's science correspondent James Randerson. For more interviews like this and the very best analysis of the worlds of science and technology, make sure you listen to our Science Weekly podcast. Head to guardian.co.uk/science for more.
Guardian Unlimited.